Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. On Capitol Hill this morning, Democrats boycotted votes on two of President Trump's cabinet picks, and they criticized him for firing the acting Attorney General Sally Yates last night after she refused to enforce Trump's travel bans. Also today, House Speaker Paul Ryan defended those orders implemented by Homeland Security Secretary John Kelly, even though in the first hours they detained professionals with green cards and at least one Iraqi translator for American troops.
No one wanted to see people with green cards or special immigrant visas like translators get caught up in all of this. And so I think there was, regrettably, the rollout was confusing. But on a go-forward basis, I'm confident that Secretary Kelly is going to make sure that this is done correctly, that they get a good review, and that we are going to make sure that we get this program up and running with the kind of vetting standards that we all want to see.
Joining us now, Ron Elving, NPR Senior Washington Editor and Correspondent. And Ron, isn't there a little more to this story here about how Ryan and others, including top cabinet picks, found out about the president's delay of entry for travelers from seven Muslim-majority countries and indefinite ban on Syrian refugees? They found out as these orders were rolled out the way the rest of us did.
That's right. They saw it on television to a large degree, and sometimes there were actually meetings taking place to discuss the order that was supposedly still in preparation, and people in those meetings looked up to see the president holding up a final copy of what he had signed. So that was obviously disturbing and distressing to people who were participating in what they thought was a decision-making process. So the enormous eagerness of the White House, and I say the White House here because it appears to have been largely driven by the White House and for some period of time, recruiting folks from Capitol Hill, staffers that is, on the House Republican side, to help them draft the document, but telling them that they weren't supposed to even talk to their bosses about it because they wanted to keep it very closely held, and then brought out very quickly last Friday because they wanted to catch any, as the president described them, bad dudes who might be trying to sneak into the country in the latest batch of refugees, and they wanted to catch those people napping.
Yeah, well, Homeland Secretary Kelly met with lawmakers this morning. He's also defending the bans publicly. He says they are not Muslim bans. But Paul Ryan also said the rhetoric prompted by the orders could be used as a recruiting tool by ISIS. Isn't that playing right into the Democrats' hands?
It might seem that way, except that the speaker could mean a number of things by that. He could mean the rhetoric we've heard from the White House, some of the people in the administration talking about how dangerous some of these folks trying to enter the United States might be. That sort of rhetoric could be interpreted as anti-Islam by some jihadists, perhaps, or used as a recruiting tool. He may also mean that some of the talk that is coming from Democrats could, in some sense or another, be used rhetorically by jihadists as a recruiting tool. So we aren't exactly sure what kind of rhetoric he was talking about at that point. He is caught in a rather difficult position on all of these issues.
Well, so are some of the president's nominees. This is intersecting with the cabinet hearings. At a meeting of the Senate Judiciary Committee this morning, California Democrat Dianne Feinstein asked what role Attorney General nominee Jeff Sessions played in drafting President Trump's executive orders on immigration.
He had to know that this type of ban would raise serious constitutional questions. He had to know that it was effectively unenforceable, but he supported it anyway.
Ron Elving, do you think there will be trouble for these nominees?
There will be trouble. Now, that does not necessarily mean that they will not be confirmed. We did not expect there to be a great number of Democratic votes for some of these nominees anyway. They now have an issue to really hang that opposition on. And we have been listening just in the last so many minutes and this morning about the objections that Democrats have on the Judiciary Committee to approving Jeff Sessions. The interesting thing is that not so long ago, Jeff Sessions on that same committee asked in very specific terms whether Sally Yates would uphold the Constitution and tell the president no if she thought the president were wrong. This was when the president was Barack Obama and Sally Yates was being nominated to be the acting, to be the acting, but at that time to be the deputy AG. That then led to her becoming the acting attorney general, the job from which she was fired last night after she said no to the president, who in this case, of course, is now President Trump.
Look, a lot of outcry, a lot of upset, but a new Rasmussen poll shows over half of the respondents supported the president's travel bans. Now, some are calling this a push poll, you know, which pushes people towards a certain response. But we are hearing from Trump voters saying this is exactly what they wanted. Not just President Trump's signing these orders, but the elevation of his advisor, Steve Bannon. What are you hearing? I mean, is this on a collision course with his own party?
To some degree, it is, because not everyone in the Republican caucus rooms of Capitol Hill is fond of Mr. Bannon. For example, Paul Ryan. Paul Ryan was very deliberately attacked by one of Steve Bannon's writers at Breitbart.com, Julia Hahn, who wrote a story saying that, well, basically, Paul Ryan was working for the election of Hillary Clinton. That story ran last fall in the heat of the general election campaign. Julia Hahn's now been hired to work with Steve Bannon in the White House. That sort of thing is not likely to make friends among some of the Republican leaders on Capitol Hill. But whether or not some of these things that are being done by this White House are going to be popular among Trump supporters, I don't think there's any surprise at all or any doubt that many of them are highly popular among Donald Trump supporters, especially among those who voted for him in the primary, as opposed to those who reluctantly perhaps came over and voted for him in November.
Now, well, for instance, today the Energy Committee confirmed Rick Perry for Energy Secretary, but Washington State Democrat Maria Cantwell says she's disturbed that President Trump removed the Energy Secretary from a permanent position on the National Security Council, of course, elevating Steve Bannon to the National Security Council. Any sense the Trump administration is backing down on those changes?
Not that we've seen so far. We did hear Sean Spicer, who is the president's communications director and press secretary, defending the role that Steve Bannon was being elevated to on the National Security Council, saying that the opposite number or the corresponding staffer for Barack Obama had been, quote, in and out of such meetings in the past. But what has happened here with Bannon is that he's been made a permanent member of the principals committee within the NSC. Mm-hmm. That is a very exalted status and an inner circle, and one that no longer normally or as a rule of just day-to-day principle is going to include the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff or the director of national intelligence. So it's really quite an exclusive group and quite an exalted role for Mr. Bannon.
How can you cut out the director of national intelligence from that inner circle? I mean,
it would appear to be a difficult thing to justify, but we'll hear much more about that from the Trump administration as they're questioned about it.
Meantime, should add, the Education Committee approved Betsy DeVos for Education Secretary, but CNN is reporting she may have plagiarized sentences in her written statements to the Senate Education Committee. So not an easy start for her. We will follow that for you all during the day. Ron Elving, NPR Senior Washington Editor and Correspondent, thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, tonight, President Trump is expected to name his nominee to the Supreme Court. Depending on how that nomination fares in the Senate, the new justice may be on the court in time to hear a case of particular interest to the president. It involves an EPA water regulation opposed by manufacturers, farmers, and as NPR's Greg Allen reports, golf course owners like President Trump.
Donald Trump owns a dozen U.S. golf courses. The jewel may be Trump National Doral here just outside Miami. It's a resort with a hotel and a spa. At a campaign event in October, Trump said he was especially proud of Doral's four golf courses.
I must tell you, the land is great. The golf courses are, as you know, the Blue Monster is one of the great courses of the world. It's a brand new Blue Monster.
Under a rule adopted by the Obama administration in 2015, the Blue Monster and all golf courses in the U.S. would be subject to closer federal regulation. The Waters of the United States rule applies clean water regulations to thousands of new streams, lakes, and wetlands. A long list of industries, including the golf industry, have fought the rule, filing lawsuits that have put it on hold. Bob Helen is with the Golf Course Superintendents Association of America. He says under the rule, courses may now need federal permission before applying fertilizer or pesticides.
Many of our routine activities would be deemed as a discharge into waters of the United States and could not move forward without getting a required permit.
Trump's course superintendents are members of Helen's association. Trump has stepped back from management, but the Trump organization still owns the courses. Now, as U.S. president, he's pledged to roll back the rule. His nominee to head the EPA, Scott Pruitt, is also a staunch opponent of the Waters of the U.S. rule. As Oklahoma Attorney General, he filed a lawsuit to overturn it. For the Trump administration, overturning the rule isn't something that can be done through executive order. The EPA would have to restart the lengthy rulemaking rulemaking process. John Devine is an attorney with the National Resources Defense Council.
Repealing a rule requires a full public process and has to be justified by the law and the evidence available. And in the case of the Clean Water Rule, that's going to be rough sledding for the Trump administration.
This month, the Supreme Court decided to weigh in, agreeing to hear a case that will determine which federal court has jurisdiction over the rule. It's possible Trump's nominee to the court will hear a case in which, as a golf course owner, he has a personal stake, creating a conflict of interest. Larry Liebesman, a former EPA and Justice Department lawyer, says any action by the White House or the EPA is now likely to be put on hold until there's a Supreme Court ruling on jurisdiction.
It gives the administration a little downtime to figure out how to handle the situation, and it also suggests that maybe Congress may step in and legislate on this issue as well.
This month, two Republican senators, Joni Ernst from Iowa and Deb Fischer from Nebraska, introduced a resolution to begin that process. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
President Trump is announcing his nominee to the Supreme Court tonight. If approved by the Senate, the person he names will fill the seat of conservative Justice Antonin Scalia, who died almost a year ago. Joining us now to talk about some of the names on the shortlist is Dahlia Lithwick. She covers courts and the law for Slate. Hi, Dahlia.
Hi there, Jeremy.
And let's talk about some of the top contenders that we're hearing about, starting with Neil Gorsuch. Who is he and what do we know about his views?
Neil Gorsuch is actually one of the people who was on Trump's long short list back when there were 21 people on it, who was really an outlier because he's very sort of blue blood, Ivy League. You know, he went to Oxford and Harvard, and most of Trump's picks initially were not that guy. He really went out of his way to get people who weren't Ivy educated, who didn't have that kind of very patrician feel that Gorsuch does. And so in a sense, the fact that he's made it this long is really, really fascinating because he very much looks like the kind of guy that Trump said all along he did not want to put on the court.
And he was a big fan of Antonin Scalia. Let's listen to him here talking about Justice Scalia last September at the 10th Circuit Judicial Conference in Colorado Springs.
Sometimes people talk about members of their profession as lions of the profession. And I often have a difficult time understanding the analogy. Not so with Justice Scalia. He had a roar that could be heard for miles.
What do we know about Gorsuch's views? Would he be another Scalia if he were to be put on the court?
In tone, no. In tone, he is very, very modulated, very careful, unbelievably affable and loved, I think universally across the 10th Circuit. But he is very much a conservative, very much himself a lion of the Federalist Society and the conservative legal movement. I think that he probably tracks Scalia's views in a lot of areas, including a real, I think, burning desire to limit judicial involvement. He's very, very interested in having, you know, the legislatures legislate and the judges stand back. So I think in tone, he won't be a bomb thrower in the manner of Scalia. But I think on issues ranging from, you know, abortion to guns to executive power, he pretty closely tracks what Scalia believed in.
Another judge being mentioned is Thomas Hardiman from the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, which is in the Northeast. He's based in Pennsylvania. Tell us about him.
Well, if I called Neil Gorsuch a blue blood, I think the answer that WAGS use on Tom Hardiman is blue collar. He's most famous for having driven a cab to get himself through law school, and really kind of very much the opposite of Gorsuch in terms of just having grown up in a normal lower middle class family, no silver spoon, and yet goes on to become, I think, a very, very well esteemed Third Circuit judge. It's worth saying here that Donald Trump's sister sits on the Third Circuit Court of Appeals. And so to the extent that there's someone whispering in the president's ear, hey, I really like this guy, it may well be that his sister admires him. Also extremely conservative by the books. Also not a bomb thrower in the manner of, say, Justice Scalia or Bill Pryor, who's another person who's been on the shortlist. Hardiman, much, much more laid back in affect.
Well, let's talk about Bill Pryor, because as you mentioned, he's also been talked about on the shortlist. What should we know about him?
Well, Bill Pryor really would be, I think, if Donald Trump wanted a fight, and particularly if he wanted a fight on abortion, which is what he's promised, Bill Pryor is that on stilts. He really has said things like Roe v. Wade is, quote, the worst abomination in the history of constitutional law. During his confirmation hearings, when he was given a chance to walk that back, he said, nope, I still think it's, you know, an abomination. He has gone out of his way, I think, throughout his career in office in Alabama to be very, very much a culture warrior. And so on issues from abortion to LGBTQ issues around the board, including violence against women and voting rights, he's been unbelievably vocal. In that sense, he's probably closer to a Scalia than the other two on the list.
Now, we know that the Democrats are already talking about a filibuster, although they don't know yet, and we don't know yet, who the nominee will be. What about the Republicans? How might these picks play with Republicans in the Senate? Do you see any circumstance under which Republicans decide that they don't like Trump's pick?
I think it's doubtful, particularly if we're looking at Hardiman or Gorsuch, who are such straight down the line, you know, I think moderate, reasonable candidates by Senate definitions. I don't think they're going to lose a lot of support there. I think that what you are seeing is Democrats trying to figure out if they want to do the big, big fight over a seat that is in effect Scalia's seat. It's not going to change the net aggregate effect on the court, or if they want to save the big, big fight for the next seat that may come up, a seat that may belong to Ruth Bader Ginsburg or Anthony Kennedy or Steve Breyer.
Well, and people have been talking about the idea that Trump could have a number of picks in his first term as president. Is that your expectation just in the few seconds we have left?
Actuarially, we're looking at 83, 80, and 78 of the judges I just mentioned. And so it's hard to envision Trump not having another pick. And as I said, I think that means that their big, big fight is coming down the pike. It's not over Scalia's seat.
I'm going to put you on the spot, Dahlia, right now. Just a one-word answer. Which pick is it going to be? Your prediction?
You know, I've been saying Pryor because I think that Trump is a thumb-in-the-eye guy.
That's Dahlia Lithwick, who covers courts and the law for Slate. We'll find out if she's right tonight. Dahlia, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Well, the company Caterpillar said this week it is moving its headquarters to Chicago after nearly a century in Peoria. The company says it wants to be closer to a global transportation hub because so much of its sales come from outside the United States. When a big company leaves a city, it can leave an economic scar. That's something the people in Sydney, Nebraska are worried about. Sydney is the corporate home of the outdoor sports retailer Cabela's, which is merging with a competitor. Grant Gerlach from Here and Now contributor Harvest Public Media reports.
When you get off of Interstate 80 here at Sydney, Cabela's makes a big impression because at the store, they've got this giant bull elk sculpture out front. There's a Cabela's water tower, and next to that, the sprawling Cabela's headquarters. I mean, this multi-billion dollar company just pops up out of the range.
That's Cabela's, the company with those huge stores that sell hunting and fishing gear. Cabela's has been based in Sydney for nearly 50 years. But now, it'll become part of another hunting fishing outfitter, Bass Pro Shops, in a $5.5 billion merger. Cabela's currently employs 2,000 people in Sydney. That leaves this town of 6,800 in western Nebraska wondering how many residents will stick around.
We're all worried. You'd be a little naive not to be.
Joey Gorman is co-owner of Dude's Steakhouse, named for his grandfather who started the place. Drive west from downtown and you'll see the cutout of a cow on the roof, a reminder that this is ranch country. Dude's has been around since 1952. Cabela's $4 billion in revenue last year helps keep it going.
Cabela's has the biggest influence on our business. They always have, and we're proud to serve Cabela's, the family, and the workers, and all the way from the top six all the way down to the warehouse workers.
Gorman is waiting to hear what's next. Bass Pro says it wants to continue the Cabela's brand and keep workers in Sydney. How many workers, they won't say.
We just hope everybody can hold on until we get a good answer and everybody can breathe a little, that the buildings are filled up and the next company would like to stay around and hopefully give us a chance too.
other towns have faced similar economic turbulence. Maytag, the appliance maker, left Newton, Iowa in 2007. HP stopped building computers in Greeley, Colorado in 2000. They adapted. Newton makes wind turbines now. The HP site is a new retail center. And Sydney itself has come through this kind of crossroads before. Outgoing Mayor Mark Nienheiser says when an Army ammunition depot closed in 1967, around 2,000 jobs went with it.
And they survived that. We're going to survive this.
The town never has matched its peak population of 8,000 in 1960, but has rebuilt while many rural towns struggle. Now the city needs to keep employment up to make new investments pay off. There's a new hospital, a new high school, and a new housing development that so far is only streets and sidewalks.
I think we're very confident that Bass Pro is going to do what they said they're going to do, and there's going to be a very significant number of jobs still here in Sydney. But we're going to look to finding new businesses to recruit to town so we can continue to grow in that way.
Businesses like Bell Lumber and Pole, which makes utility poles. It opened last year. 40 acres of logs, fir, cedar, and pine, stacked up like Lincoln logs. They'll be weatherized here and shipped across the country. Mark O'Dell is the plant manager.
We currently have 41 employees. Most of them do live out of Sydney. The farthest our employees drive would be from Kimball, 16-some miles, you know, to the west.
Bell Lumber is not like Cabela's. It's small, it's blue-collar, but it shows Sydney has assets, starting with its location. It's on the Union Pacific and Burlington Northern Railroads and right on Interstate 80 and U.S. 385, which runs from Canada to Mexico. With or without Cabela's, at least that gives Sydney a path forward. For Here and Now, I'm Grant Gerlach, reporting from Sydney, Nebraska.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Blue Apron, partnering with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to deliver all you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come pre-measured, so there's no food waste. Recycle the packaging or mail it back, postage free, and Blue Apron will recycle for you. Rediscover how fun cooking can be. Enjoy seasonally inspired recipes and explore new cuisines. No commitment. Get meals only when you want. Get your first three meals free plus free shipping at blueapron.com/here.
With a vote scheduled tomorrow, British lawmakers are debating the bill that authorizes Prime Minister Theresa May to start talks to leave the European Union. The British people voted for Brexit last June, and today Brexit Secretary David Davis urged Parliament to honor their will, but MP Kenneth Clark disagreed.
I do believe that it is a very, very bad move, particularly for our children and grandchildren, that we're all sitting here now saying that we're embarking on a new unknown future.
BBC political correspondent Rob Watson is in London. Rob, how would you characterize all this?
It was fascinating that you picked that clip of Kenneth Clark, a veteran pro-European Conservative MP. If I'd had to pick one from their side, I would have picked that one, so compliments, Robin, on whoever fished it out. And I think it really sums up what I would call the Remain side of the argument, and that is those MPs who have a real sense of foreboding. They think that the economic future is uncertain. On the Leave side, of course, we heard a lot of MPs for whom this was just an immense celebration. One described it, pro-Brexit MP described it as the moment of quiet revolution. You could not have a starker contrast.
Well, you said something before we went on air about this actually being something of a requiem.
I think that's certainly the way those who are on the Remain side of the argument, both inside and outside Parliament, would feel. That I think they would describe it as a requiem for a kind of Britain, for its place in Europe, the things that they were familiar with, the idea of freedom of movement between Britain and the rest of the European Union, all of those things that they have stood by and which they believe, their side believes, has contributed to the prosperity and peace of this country for the last 40-odd years. I mean, they fear that that is going away. I mean, one has to emphasise, of course, the other side think, no, this is all a bright new future.
Well, and we just had your Prime Minister, Theresa May, visiting with President Donald Trump last week, making that announcement in their press conference afterwards that he had told her that he was 100% on board with NATO, with the future of NATO, even though in his campaigning he was very much dissing NATO. Well, how do people in Britain feel about that? Do they trust what Theresa May seems to trust?
First of all, Theresa May and her government, they've bet the farm, as it were, on Donald Trump and having close relationship with the current administration in Washington, given that Britain's alienating itself from Brussels. And I guess what I would say is that it's proving to be a pretty risky bet, because Donald Trump is not popular, broadly speaking, in the United Kingdom. I mean, he's just, if I could use again a British expression, he's not everyone's cup of tea. Now, Downing Street is sort of doubling down on the bet, saying, look, some people in Britain may be worried about things like the new immigration measures, but that in the longer term, Britain's pivot towards the Donald Trump White House away from Brussels is one almighty risk.
Well, right now, more than a million people in your country have signed a petition against the Trump state visit to the UK, which Theresa May announced when she was here. He'll be meeting the Queen. We'll see what happens then. But meanwhile, this vote tomorrow in the House of Commons, isn't it pretty much assumed that it's going to give the government the go-ahead to proceed with Brexit, that the debate today is just pro forma?
I think that perhaps the real political difficulties for Theresa May, and not with this bill, this will go through, it's how Parliament, how the country will react to the 2 years of negotiations with the remaining EU 27 countries. For now, politics is a short-term, as long as a long-term game, she's in charge.
The BBC's Rob Watson. Rob, thank you.
Cheers. Thanks.
More than half the investment in new electricity generation is in renewable energy, more than $300 billion a year globally, according to Bloomberg New Energy Finance. President Trump has said the push toward renewable energy is being driven by, quote, the mistaken belief that global climate change is being caused by carbon emissions. But there's now some consensus that the federal government has relatively little control over American energy policy. The horse has left the barn. Oil companies are starting wind farms. 29 states have renewable fuel standards. Republicans, notably Iowa's senior Senator Charles Grassley, are looking to increase wind energy. And according to the Department of Labor, the fastest growing job in the U.S. is wind turbine technician, expected to grow by more than 100% over the next decade. So how do you get one of those jobs? Well, Daniel Lutat is director of the Sustainable Energy Resources and Technologies at Iowa Lakes Community College. He's at the campus in Estherville, Iowa. Dan, so what exactly is a wind technician?
A wind technician is a person who basically is kind of a jack of all trades. You're maintaining everything from power generation systems to mechanical systems, instrumentation, communication systems. You know, really each turbine can be viewed like an airplane on a stick, I guess. So in everything from the construction phase all the way through the operations and maintenance in the post-warranty phase, these technicians really are bumper-to-bumper maintenance guys.
And women?
Oh, absolutely. And I use guys in kind of a general term.
Yeah, we do
have women, and that's something that I, you know, specifically like to talk about, because this is a what you would consider a gender non-traditional field. And in an effort to get more of that diverse thinking into our workforce, right now, if a young lady comes into these technical fields, they're basically writing their own tickets. So it's something where we've lost their brain power in the technical fields, and we're really trying hard to get it back.
Okay, so what do you have to have already before you decide to go study this? High school grad, any years at college, what do you have to have?
Yeah, a high school grad with a good solid foundation in algebra and, some basic physics is always a plus. You're dealing with everything from mechanical forces to electrical forces, and obviously that requires a good background in algebra, primarily because you're using complex equations to solve those electrical issues when you troubleshoot.
And there you are in Iowa, the state that's working towards getting 40% of its power from wind. So what is the degree? How much does it cost?
Total for about the 2 years, you know, and you're looking at including room and board at Iowa Lakes is going to run about $21,000 for both years. And that's if you don't get any scholarships. And of course, you know, we're pretty darn good with scholarships. We give out about $1 million in scholarships a year. And one thing that helps offset that is the internships that we have between the first and second year. And lots of students will actually go out and earn enough money to pay for their entire college in one internship. So that's where they get their first exposure to what kind of opportunities are actually out there.
Well, we've seen huge wind farms, you know, in Southern California, farms being built offshore here on the East Coast. But it doesn't feel as if it's enough right now in the U.S. to accommodate, you know, huge graduating classes. So how many students do you have? What's their job placement rate? And I guess we should remind people that they might go around the world.
Well, yeah, let's talk about job placement first. Really, job placement takes care of itself. The dilemma that graduates have from these programs is that they've got to choose which company to take a job with. They're being fought over because the demand for properly trained technicians is very high. And that's another point to emphasize too. You know, not all of the programs are the same. Some are tailored to people that have prior industry experience in another field that are looking to get some exposure to the turbines, and those are more academy-style approaches that are much shorter in duration. We take the old-school approach that there is no shortcut to building a good technician, so our program is a 2-year program. We also have a 1-year diploma option for those people that already have some technical experience. But what you're really looking at is making sure that you can get the right foundation so that when you go out to work for these companies, they can polish you the rest of the way on the style of turbine that you're going to work on.
Well, and ask about numbers, because I absolutely remember when President Obama first came into office, we did a number of stories on this great move to convert community colleges to teaching solely, you know, turbine technology, because there's going to be a lot of money to do things like take linemen, people who'd worked for telephone companies. Those jobs are all different now because of wireless, and take some of them and retrain them to work on turbines. And it didn't happen because the money wasn't there. So how many students do you have?
Well, and again, the student population varies based on demand. Now that we have the Department of Labor reporting the progress we're making in the field in terms of demand, we're seeing our numbers go back up. So we've got about 50 students in the pipeline right now. And what we're finding is those numbers are starting to go up now that folks are able to go out there to the labor statistics page and actually download, you know, those top career fields and figure out where they want to be if they're looking for a technical home.
Well, and the government's Wind Energy Technology Basics website, last updated in 2013, says there are wind facilities in 40 states, 75,000 jobs. As we said, that's arcing up. But I mentioned foreign countries. Are there partnerships there?
Most of the companies we deal with are global companies. So when the wind techs go out there, they typically find themselves in positions where they are traveling abroad. It's not uncommon for a student to be out there after graduation for a year, year and a half. And if they blaze a trail for themselves, you know, they're going to places like Brazil or the Far East or over to Europe. So, you know, it really is a global market. And when companies find those technicians that they can rely on to travel abroad and lead teams, those are the ones that get selected to do it.
So how much can you make?
Our wind techs are making $55,000 to $90,000 with an associate degree right out the door. That's going to go up depending on what category of technician you are. If you're a stationary technician, you're going to be a little bit on the lower side for a few years. And then as you gain experience, that's going to go up pretty good. The ones that really make the most are the traveling technicians, but that's for several reasons. You know, number one, they're getting travel pay, but at the same time, they're getting invaluable experience on a wide variety of platforms. So they become more valuable to the companies.
Yeah. And so what do you think of President Trump taking office? He's called climate change a hoax. He's talking about fossil fuels, building pipelines and such, not as much about alternative energy. There is this conventional wisdom that it doesn't matter anymore. In fact, there was an example given of a government bidding war for a future wind farm, and the winner was an oil company, you know, bidding on it. So the thinking is that there's nothing that can stop the market move towards alternative fuels. Do you feel that way?
Oh, absolutely. And here's the thing you need to understand. Where wind energy is concerned, there is no better business case, and that's for several reasons. Number one, we provide the kind of clean output that you know, your larger gas-fired and coal-fired plants really love, because we can be switched on and off at a moment's notice. So when you make the tie to the fossil fuel companies, you're right on the money. The fossil fuel companies, ironically, are the ones that have the capital to make these large-scale developments. And it really helps their business case, too, because it preserves that resource and at the same time diversifies their portfolio. So it's a win-win for everybody. And you won't find a utility-scale business anywhere that gives you that kind of a return. So when it comes to wind energy, I think especially where Iowa is concerned, you've seen a lot of Democrat and Republican cooperation on this. It's simply because it's a good thing. We can generate 10 times more electricity from wind alone than the continent's going to use for the foreseeable future. So that's really what this kind of bridge technology does for us.
Everybody's worried about jobs. Do you think the skills of steel workers or oil workers are transferable to wind?
Yeah, a lot of the skills are. You know, when you think about a wind turbine, it's really a giant robot. That's no different than the facilities we work in, our homes, our offices, our cars, our aircraft, you know, trains, everything like that. So when it comes to the turbine itself, a lot of those skills are transferable. So it's just a matter of getting somebody in that's willing to make that change, willing to come back and get used to the climbing and what it's like to work safely at heights. And once they realize how similar the technology really is, they can take off with it.
Work safely at height. Is it a little bit like the lineman, the Wichita lineman, you know?
Yeah. In some respects, it is. A little bit different because you're 300 feet in the air. But the bottom line is, you know, we teach a very healthy dose of responsibility for others. That's a key mantra of the wind industry. And that's why they have a really good safety record, because every day you come to work, you have an understanding that someone's life is in your hands and vice versa. And so safety is the number one starting point for this industry, and that's really a good thing. You don't find too many industries that are as good from a safety partnership aspect as the wind industry.
That's Dan Lutat, Director of Sustainable Energy Resources and Technologies at Iowa Lakes Community College in Estherville, Iowa. They've earned the American Wind Energy Seal of Approval for their training program there, something that's shared by seven other institutions. And they are training what is said to be the fastest growing job in the United States, a wind power technician. Dan, thank you.
Not a problem. Anything else you need, just give me a holler.
Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos is leading the charge in the tech industry against President Trump's latest immigration order, which temporarily halts entry for all refugees, as well as all citizens of seven predominantly Muslim countries. In an email sent to employees yesterday, he said the company will fight the order on Capitol Hill and in the courts. Separately, several technology firms are meeting today to decide how they will respond. But it's not just that immigration ban that has upset tech leaders. For more, let's go to our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Ed Lee is managing editor of Recode. He joins us from New York. Hi, Ed.
Hi.
And tell us, first of all, what exactly Jeff Bezos is planning.
Well, he's trying to work with lobbyists and also legislators in his home state of Washington to sort of figure out ways that they can combat this executive order, or at least find ways around it, legal ways, of course. And that's a really significant step. Instead of just having a statement or sort of like a saying one way or the other what they think or feel about it, he's actually trying to take some action. So that I think is a big deal.
And he's an unusual tech leader because in addition to being a leader in the tech world, he also owns The Washington Post, which is a paper that has had its problems with Donald Trump, and Donald Trump has had his problems with The Washington Post.
And all of media, practically, including The New York Times and CNN. So, yeah, that is an interesting thing that sort of underscores this. But sort of to be clear, I think a good thing to sort of be aware of is that, you know, it's Jeff Bezos personally who owns The Washington Post and not Amazon, you know, his company, which is a publicly traded company. I think there was this conspiracy or there's this idea that was touted that somehow owning the Post was a sort of a way to kind of get tax benefit for Amazon. And that is not the case at all.
There's also this meeting of several tech firms today, originally reported by Reuters. Not a lot of details, but how have the other leaders in Silicon Valley responded to the executive order from Trump?
So unlike Bezos, I mean, most of the reactions have been fairly tepid. I think, you know, altogether they're trying to sort of promote their company's values, which is inclusiveness generally, and of course immigration. A lot of the founders of these companies are immigrants or family come from families of immigrants, but they're not going whole hog either, right? I think Reed Hastings, the CEO of Netflix, is probably the only one who's been very, very vocal in saying this is simply wrong and un-American. Most of the others have been sort of saying something along the lines of, you know, we don't agree with this order, but we'll try to work with the administration or something to that effect.
Although didn't Sergey Brin from Google find himself at a protest the other day against it?
He did. In fact, the protest or the rally was at Google campus, where at least a few thousand Google workers sort of heard Sergey talk about his background of being an immigrant and that how he's against it. And they sort of did a rally around the Google campus in Mountain View, and as well as other Google offices around the world.
Now, there's also talk about something that would be even more significant in Silicon Valley, and that is a potential executive order coming from the Trump White House that would restrict H-1B visas. Now, remind us, first of all, what those are and what do we know about this potential executive order?
So the H-1B is a special program, sort of a work visa that where companies like Microsoft and Google and Facebook can bring in workers from overseas under this visa, high-skilled labor, engineers in particular. And that's what these companies – they really rely on that because, frankly, the U.S. doesn't produce enough workers in this field. And they're having to go overseas to China and Russia and India and Pakistan largely to get workers to do this stuff.
So what's the argument against having the H-1B visa system the way that it is right now?
Well, the argument on one end really is that, you know, as far as tech companies are concerned, they want this program to be expanded. We need more, along with getting more education for science, technology, engineering, and math. The Trump administration, and I think Steve Bannon, the advisors, a big part of that push is to try to limit as much inflow as possible, whether it's from what they think of as nations where terrorists come from, but also just nations that aren't typically Christian, you know. And I think that's a fundamental cultural divide here, but that's now manifesting in policy.
But again, we don't know yet whether this executive order is on the way.
We don't. And it's an evaluation, and likely it's another way of kind of trying to vet or revet this program to either curtail it. And there's still a chance that he expands it. So we're not going to say either way, since we don't really know.
One more thing I want to ask you about, some other news. Elon Musk from Tesla, the company officially brought a project online yesterday that would help promote clean energy in California. What's going on?
So, you know, that's Elon Musk behind Tesla and electric batteries is a big proponent of, you know, environmental solutions to the problems, as well as making profit off of it. And that's an interesting thing, because he's also aligned with the Trump administration as part of his advisory council. So there is a potential meeting of the minds here in terms of what that might mean in terms of policy, things like carbon tax and curbing carbon emissions.
Hmm. Well, we'll be watching that to see what happens. Ed Lee, managing editor at Recode, thank you.
Anytime.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.